Hello, and thank you for joining this MedCast series titled Achieving Durable Clinical Response with Targeted Treatments for Vitiligo. My name is Dr. Raj Chovatiya. I'm an assistant professor of dermatology at the Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine in Chicago, Illinois.
And I am Dr. Chris Budick, an associate professor of dermatology at the Yale School of Medicine in New Haven, Connecticut.
So in today's exciting episode, we're going to delve into advancements in targeted treatments for vitiligo, a disease perhaps we weren't talking too much about a few years ago, but really we're going to have a chance to explore the potential to provide long-term efficacy and durable clinical response when it comes to treatment. Thank you so much, everyone, for joining us. Let's begin. Chris, maybe I can get you to start talking a little bit about vitiligo. Why is this a disease we need to think about when it comes to treating our patients? What kind of impact is this having on quality of life for the individuals that come to see us? Is this a cosmetic condition? Is this a medical condition? What's the story?
Well, I think it's both a medical and a cosmetic condition. I remember growing up as a child, and the talk when I was a kid was about Michael Jackson. And I think that the world really became aware of vitiligo, in a way, through this celebrity. But now what we're finding is that people are both concerned about their appearance. Aesthetics is so important to well-being, self-motivation, feelings of self-worth and happiness. So the aesthetics and cosmetic component of vitiligo is incredibly important. But we as dermatologists and in the scientific community realize that the underpinnings of vitiligo truly have medical origins. They have scientific origins. And truly, when you compare vitiligo to psoriasis and atopic dermatitis, we're sort of behind the game in understanding the science of vitiligo. And it's only in the last few years where we've really seen a lot of breakthroughs that have led to some new therapies.
It's amazing that really it's probably the last 15 years that we've really begun to unravel some of the autoimmune inflammatory mechanisms behind disease. And it's interesting you talk about this idea where we didn't really think about vitiligo the way we do now. But, you know, I feel like we've begun to understand that so much of what our skin looks like is a part of our identity and who we are. And it's really hard to capture that perhaps through conventional measures, which is maybe why some have said, hey, this isn't something you need to treat. But when you think about it, that perhaps is most important to our patients compared to anything else. And really in some nice, elegant experiments over the last couple of decades, we've really begun to hone in on the fact that, you know, that CD8 positive T cells are one important part of this arm. We know that interferon gamma is an important signal in terms of this actual activity as well. There's a loop with CXCL9 and CXCL10, our chemokines, that are really driving this interaction between our immune system, keratinocytes, and melanocytes.
Well, I think you touched on the science very nicely. So when we think about the pathogenesis of vitiligo, I think that it's very much a multifactorial process. And so what the science is leading us to understand is there's a genetic component, right? There is an autoimmune component. There's an inflammation component. There's an oxidative stress component. And there's also a hypothesis around neurons, so a neural hypothesis about some of the factors that are discharged by the neurons at the end towards the melanocytes can actually play a role in damaging the melanocytes. And some of the new science shows that little bits of all of these pathways can intersect to cause vitiligo. And I think the way to summarize all of this is that there are, just like in psoriasis and AD, what we're finding that there's molecular endotypes. There are subsets of patients that have different types of main drivers of their pathogenesis. So together, all of these factors play a role, but different patients may have slightly different chemokines, cytokines, inflammatory markers that are driving their disease more than other. And I think that the way that manifests clinically is not all vitiligo is the same. We have some patients that have one or two lesions. Some are on the face, some may be on the hands, some may be on the trunk. And then we have other patients who have whole body vitiligo. And so I think that seeing the patients and their different clinical appearances is now correlating with what we're finding scientifically about how the complexities of how deep the signaling and the inflammation, the autoimmune, you mentioned the CD8 positive lymphocytes, T cell lymphocytes that are really attacking and doing damage to the melanocytes. It's really fascinating. And when you look at all this science, I think vitiligo is one of the most exciting diseases to be at the forefront of research because of all of this.
I mean, I couldn't have put that better myself. I mean, your passion is clearly palpable. I know that I get really excited when I think about what's happening in the therapeutic space. And you really described quite nicely this idea that not all vitiligo is the same. And historically, the biggest division here has been sort of segmental and non-segmental. And that's a lot of where this discussion comes in terms of, is there a neuronal basis to some of this that's more relevant versus other cells? And the vast majority of probably what we see on a day-to-day basis is the non-segmental type, really the one that can have this waxing and waning course over a long period and one that tends to be more responsive to treatment. But by and large, our approaches to vitiligo are pretty much quite similar up until somewhat recently. We think about topical corticosteroids, topical calcineurin inhibitors, really broad-acting topical anti-inflammatory therapies that can work in some cases, but really you're limited oftentimes on potency and location and vehicle type, meaning that it's not going to be a great choice for all patients. We know that the idea of light is something that's really important for really driving both not only the shutting down of inflammation, but then the actual repopulation of melanocytes in the cells. And so narrowband UVB is something that we tend to combine quite a bit with our therapies. You know, the data behind a lot of our oral immunosuppressants is sort of mixed. They don't really work the same way that you think about with atopic dermatitis and psoriasis. And for some really rapidly progressive cases, there's some data to suggest that smaller pulse dosing of steroids can be helpful as well. But bottom line, the reason why I speak about this in such high-level terms is we never really had great studies, good numbers, good data to suggest what we were doing is actually the best approach when it comes to treatment.
Yeah, I think in some ways, approaching the vitiligo patient, it's a very difficult patient to necessarily design the same trials that we do in AD and psoriasis. I think it's a much harder disease to try to capture. And that is really what's been a clinical breakthrough in the last decade, is now we have some trials, and we're going to talk about one of those trials or some of those trials in the next few minutes. But those breakthroughs in being able to capture really the vitiligo disease area, right, and capture that, and then do it on the face, do it on the whole body, and be able to correlate that really with repigmentation, which is, we've been talking just about the pathogenesis. We haven't even gotten into the fact that, well, not only do you have to stop what's driving the disease, but how do you actually then do the second part, which is re-stimulate the pigmentation so that you actually can have uniform skin tone again? I know when I was a resident training, really it was topical corticosteroids, topical calcineurin inhibitors, and you mentioned the narrowband UVB and pulse steroids. That's really what we had. And so I think with the advent of JAK inhibitors, which we're going to get into, I think that that really has revolutionized treatment of vitiligo. But you mentioned the narrowband UVB. So it actually turns out that when there is a whole active scientific area just on understanding how phototherapy impacts the skin. But it turns out narrowband UVB can actually reduce oxidative stress. And so there is, we mentioned oxidative stress is one thing that can hurt melanocytes in the pathogenesis of vitiligo. So narrowband UVB, besides other anti-inflammatory properties, it actually can reduce oxidative stress as well. So there's a lot to learn about these treatments and how they work and intersect with pathogenesis of vitiligo.
No, I love how you mentioned the fact that even though we think we understand a treatment, we've used it for a long time, there's still so much to really unravel there. And maybe that can be the sequel to our conversation. But you mentioned JAK inhibitors. I think now is the time to jump into, I think there's been a really exciting part of both of our careers in the last couple years in terms of really not only the science, the medicine, the education. And I think probably the best place to start is the fact of what are JAK inhibitors. Small molecules that inhibit an important conserved signaling pathway that's really relevant across a lot of the immune system and thus a lot of dermatologic disease. So based on some of those signals I mentioned, cytokines, chemokines, all these different soluble mediators, you could imagine that a protein has to signal to a cell somehow. And so you can think of the Janus kinase family, JAK1, JAK2, JAK3, and TYK2, really being sort of that combinatorial system that recognizes a signal on the outside of the cell, causes a cascade on the inside of the cell through phosphorylation, activation of STAT proteins, signal transducers, and activators of transcription. Those go directly into the nucleus, and that's how you get changes on transcriptional and then translational programs for inflammation. And some of the really interesting observations that were made over the past of the last decade and a half was that, interestingly, patients who were treated with JAK inhibitors for a variety of reasons, sometimes related to the vitiligo and sometimes not, interestingly showed some degree of repigmentation. And And the idea here, based on a lot of the animal models, was this was really cutting down on the interferon gamma-mediated signaling that was driving a lot of that T-cell lymphocyte activity we talked about. And so one of the first trials to mature in this area has been for topical ruxolitinib, ruxolitinib being sort of a JAK1-2 type inhibitor, though we obviously know that based on active site inhibition, there can be sort of some degree of binding across all JAK proteins when you look at sort of in vitro data. But bottom line, you can think of ruxolitinib working in that fashion. And this is what gets us to the TRuE-V1, TRuE-V2 trial program. Maybe you can tell us a little bit more about some of the general setup and key takeaways of ruxolitinib cream in the TRuE-V1 and 2 phase 3 trials, Chris.
Yeah, so I think that with ruxolitinib cream, so with this particular JAK inhibitor, it has selectivity against JAK1 and JAK2. So you mentioned interferon gamma. And when we think about the JAK family as a whole, the JAK1, 2, 3, and TYK2, we have to remember, the good way to think about them is they're really co-receptors, right? So you have the interferon gamma and the interferon gamma receptor. So the interferon gamma is signaling on the outside of the cell. And on the inside of the cell, that receptor, the interferon gamma receptor, has to somehow translate that signal, as you said, into transcriptional and translational programs. And it turns out that in the case of vitiligo, the JAK1, JAK2 being those mediators between the interferon gamma receptor and the STAT activation actually is very important in the pathogenesis of vitiligo. And ruxolitinib is able to target that JAK1 and that JAK2. When you think of all of these families of JAKs, it's very important to remember that in each of these different proteins, they have two homologous domains, kinase domains. Most of the JAK inhibitors, when we say JAK inhibition, they're targeting, when they target JAK1, JAK2, JAK3, they're truly targeting what's known as the kinase domain. But there's actually a very homologous, what's called pseudokinase domain, not just in TYK2, but in JAK1, JAK2, JAK3. And so over the last, people think that JAK inhibitors are really new, meaning that they just came onto the scene in the last couple of years. Well, that's true for patient therapy, but these have been in development for almost three or more decades. And when we think about this, we're actually, in the case of vitiligo, targeting a specific domain of two JAKs and trying to decrease the impact the interferon gamma, as well as other signaling pathways, may have on the loss of pigmentation. So in the TRuE-V1 and TRuE-V2 studies, these were phase 3 clinical trials that were really aimed at trying to understand the efficacy of ruxolitinib inhibiting JAK1 and JAK2 and how this could lead to repigmentation of vitiligo skin. And there's two ways that you could measure this. You could measure this with what is known as the facial vitiligo area severity index, or FVASI, and this could be measured, you know, at the 25%, 50%, 75%, or 90% level. Then you also had the ability to calculate the total VASI response at those same levels, 25%, 50%, 75%, 90%. And so this was actually a really well-designed study capturing a lot of data. How well did patients repigment with ruxolitinib that was applied in general twice daily to about 300, I believe, patients in each arm? And how well did they repigment at multiple levels and at what time frame? And the time frames that were primarily looked at were around 24 weeks, what we think of as 6 months. I think, you know, 4 weeks a month, I just round up to about 6 months.
If I could jump in right there, and I don't want to sort of stop that train from rolling, I think it's really important people realize that vitiligo is a very different disease than atopic dermatitis and psoriasis. Looking at 3 months, looking at 4 months, looking at 2 weeks is not the way we think about vitiligo. From what you had so eloquently put, there's two important steps: stopping the inflammation, but then also driving the repigmentation as well. And so our just overall time order has to be different when thinking about our therapies. The other point that you mentioned so nicely is that looking at facial repigmentation versus the whole body, different areas of the body repigment at different rates. And it's believed that this probably has something to do with the actual melanocytic progenitor reservoir that's in the bulge region of various hair follicles. And we know that some areas are more dense with hair follicles, some are less. And so I think it's important to keep those two things in mind for anybody that might be treating a vitiligo patient or even examining some of the data from a study to understand that time and location are both very different when we think about vitiligo compared to other diseases.
Yeah, absolutely. what I was going to say about the timing is very simple, is that when it comes to treating vitiligo patients, we have to have patience, right? Patients need patience. Doctors need patience. And it's kind of the opposite of what's happening in dermatology elsewhere. When you think of psoriasis and atopic dermatitis, what's happening right now in our specialty is
how fast can you
get rid of the itch? How fast can you clear their skin? But that approach, that mentality doesn't work for vitiligo patients. And I would make an argument that you might stress out your vitiligo patients. You might set them up for disappointment if you tell them, we're going to have you better in a week, we're going to have you better in a month. That's not how this disease is going to work. You have to be patient. And I think that this trial, if you look at the endpoints, at 6 months and then going out to 52 weeks, a year, there was a significant difference in the response of patients between 6 months and a year. What we saw when we consider the facial improvement, the facial VASI 75, at 6 months, about a third of patients had achieved that goal. But when you wait and you keep using the medicine and you go out to a year, that went up above 50%.
The majority, right?
Yeah. The majority. And so when you're talking to your patients, so I always like to take these studies and reprocess them into, how do I have a communicable message to my patient that gives them hope? So my message here would be, this is a disease that takes a long time to correct. There is hope with ruxolitinib. The data shows that over half the patients will have VASI 75 repigmentation at 1 year. So we're in this together for the long run. I'm going to walk you step by step through it. We're going to be here a year from now, and I think that we're going to achieve really good results.
The other wrinkle in that data is that when you sort of take a look at the total body VASI score, that actually moves even slower compared to the facial, because you're combining all these regions of the body, some that work a little quicker, some that are a little slower, but the same pattern emerges, that as you start to just wait 6 months, go to the extension of 52 weeks and potentially beyond, you also see that rise as well. And so I think that it really preaches patience for all areas of the body and really tells us that, you know, not only is efficacy going to take time, the one part you didn't mention, safety was really promising during this whole period as well. So there's been, you know, a lot of general concerns about JAK inhibition as a therapeutic modality when it comes to thinking about class-wide warnings. And that's not necessarily the focus of our conversation, but I do want to make an important point that whether you're looking at the primary placebo-controlled treatment period, whether you're looking at the overall extension, really you weren't piling up many significant worrisome safety events, and it was sort of some of minor things you think about with topicals. And I don't want to minimize any warnings and whatnot, but I do think that it's very promising that even the way that the actual therapy is indicated in terms of the indication statement, some patients may require longer, more continuous treatment, and that looks like it's an okay strategy both from an efficacy and safety standpoint.
Yeah, Raj, I'll tell you, you know there that I've been in kind of at the forefront here of talking about JAK inhibitor safety. You know, my research group put out a paper end of last year looking at the oral JAK inhibitors and their safety in atopic dermatitis compared to systemic immunotherapies that had traditionally been used. And actually, the data was a little bit surprising in that the JAK inhibitors seem to be safer. And when you come to vitiligo and using ruxolitinib topically, it's even safer. And I think that I always, when I talk to my patients, I do the own family test. Would I use this on myself or my children? And I would use ruxolitinib in my children if they had vitiligo, 100%. You mentioned what were some of the reactions. So if you look at the top two reactions from the TRuE-V1, TRuE-V2, the only ones that were above 5% were application site issues, application site acne, and then application site pruritus. And then less than 5%, there are a couple other application site issues. But as a whole, very safe, no major signals that occurred in the TRuE-V1, TRuE-V2, or in the extension trials. Nothing that I think relates to the box warnings that the FDA did put on JAK inhibitors in dermatology.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, one of the most interesting parts of the ruxolitinib story has kind of come this year with sort of the release of some even further longer-term data in terms of what's happening after that one-year period. What happens when you stretch things out to a couple years? And I won't steal your efficacy thunder because I want to hear kind of your encapsulation of what we've learned about people who stay on therapy versus discontinue therapy. But from a safety standpoint, when you start adjusting for incidence rates based on the amount of patient years here, you're really not seeing any of these events pop up that you think about from the boxed warning. So this would include major adverse cardiovascular events, venothrombolic events, malignancies, mortality, infections, really the things that, you know, came about due to a lot of studies related to oral JAK inhibition, perhaps in different disease states. And, you know, it's something that we just have to deal with as a reality for discussion with our patients. But I think that the way you talked about taking the data and how can I make this to a communicable message for my patients, it's really important we arm ourselves with sort of the latest safety cuts, because oftentimes that's the first thing that's going to be on the back of somebody's mind when they get that prescribing information and they see all this bold wording on the front of it. And the efficacy almost gets pushed down a little bit, but I definitely don't want to water down that safety message, but I just want to say that I feel very reassured about what we've learned in terms of the additional year of data that was presented earlier this year. But I want to kind of pick your brain a little bit, and maybe you can tell me what we've learned about people who sort of withdraw from therapy versus continue on with therapy that are having good responses to topical ruxolitinib.
Yeah, I think that this is very fascinating and also very encouraging for vitiligo patients. So recently we had the American Academy of Dermatology annual meeting in New Orleans, and there was some late-breaking research that was discussed there about ruxolitinib in their long-term extension trial from extending out from the TRuE-V1 and TRuE-V2. And what they really wanted to do was ask the question, if you were to actually stop ruxolitinib, if you had good response and you stopped it, how did the patients fare? How did they maintain the repigmentation? Did they lose it? If they lost it, how quickly? And if they restarted the therapy, what happened?
This is the kind of real-world question our patients are always asking us, right? Yeah.
This is the real-world practical application, really, yeah. So what was observed is very fascinating. So the patients that achieved facial VASI 90 went on in this long-term extension and were kind of divided equally into two arms. One arm continued the ruxolitinib cream twice daily, and the other arm was withdrawn and observed. So interestingly, about two-thirds of patients that just continued ruxolitinib maintained this facial VASI 90. So the first piece of information is that if you responded very well at year one, you have a two-thirds chance that you're going to continue to respond just as well for a whole nother year.
And that's setting it at that threshold of facial VASI 90. What I don't want people to take away is that sort of all response is lost. We know that there's some degree of fluctuation. Some individuals perhaps have an 80-something percent improvement. And so this is setting very stringent endpoints.
Absolutely. You know, the standard of care in psoriasis and AD has not, it's no longer PASI 75. It's no longer EASI 75. It's all moved up really to PASI 90, 100 and EASI 90. And I think in vitiligo, we're not quite there. We still really the VASI 75. So VASI 90 for vitiligo is really high bar.
I admire the fact that they kind of went for it here in a trial design. And like you said, in terms of some of the actual trial design principles here, like bravo in terms of really Absolutely. Trying to set that bar high.
Agree 100%. So what's really fascinating is that about 20%, one in five patients that were withdrawn from the ruxolitinib also maintained their facial VASI 90. So that's actually also really encouraging that for a whole year, you could keep that response. And I think that what dictates whether you maintain the repigmentation or you lose it goes back to that scientific discussion we had. There's going to be different molecular endotypes of vitiligo patients. And so not all patients are going to respond the same, but certainly there's a subgroup with a certain molecular endotype that is, I guess, has this proclivity towards a very durable response.
And we don't even completely understand the natural course of history of vitiligo itself, and so some of this could be baked in here as well. As we know, the disease can wax and wane and stabilize at certain periods of time throughout somebody's life, and so we're kind of in our infancy of understanding this, but frankly, it's something we don't even look at much with atopic dermatitis and psoriasis as well, so important to keep in the back of our minds that we know that there's some inherent disease-specific ways that vitiligo can get worse and get better, and that there probably is something very unique about certain constellations of molecular signatures and individuals on treatment as well. But that's astounding, right? Two big important points. If you're doing well and you stay on therapy, you're going to maintain generally the response that you want. If you stay off of therapy, probably most people are going to lose perhaps that threshold of response you're looking for. There's a chunk of people that will keep it, but it does really help to answer a different question that our patients oftentimes ask us the moment they start therapy: when can I stop? They haven't even used it once, and the first question is, when can I stop? And I think with this type of disease state, this type of mechanism with JAK inhibition, probably your best strategy is going to be some type of chronic treatment. Chronic disease, chronic treatment. And I think I try to make that argument to my patients when we're having that discussion. Now, I think what would be really interesting, if we could figure out some way to say, is there a middle ground where perhaps you don't use it at all, perhaps you're not using it every day, but it's some more intermittent type treatment, and maybe that's enough to actually maintain response. And I think the real world sort of case reports and series and data is going to probably help teach us something about the mechanism of vitiligo even a little further.
Absolutely. So we were talking about VASI 90. So what happened with if we lower that stringent, you know, threshold to VASI 75? And so about 40% of the patients that withdrew from the ruxolitinib treatment a year later maintained facial VASI 75.
So you talked about 20% for 90, about 40% for 75. So telling us that actually it's a pretty big chunk of patients that are having a meaningful response. And I think that in our trials, it seems like 75% repigmentation of the face is probably coming out to be a meaningful endpoint for our patients.
Well, just having seen so many vitiligo patients over the last decade, you realize that for me, when you see response, even if it's not 100%, it's meaningful to the patient. You see how happy, you see the real joy that patients have when they see repigmentation occur. To me, that is absolutely meaningful. For me, the VASI 50 would be very meaningful, but we're talking about VASI 75. Now, 29% of the patients that withdrew for ruxolitinib actually fell below the facial VASI 75 level. And those that fell below, around 50% did so. They had the loss of the pigmentation within 4 months of stopping. So there was a subset that had a very rapid loss of the pigment, whereas others didn't. And not to belabor the molecular endotype point, but there's a lot of science to be learned about how these different populations of patients are responding.
Isn't it amazing how I feel like one of the biggest evolutions in the last few years of trials, and this is particularly with JAK inhibition, has been real biological observations that have come out of study design, particularly in terms of the longer-term data related to actual placebo withdrawal or actual maintenance of response or changing of dosing. You've really seen it across multiple disease states, including vitiligo, and it's really exciting when the clinical data can inform the next scientific questions about what you want to understand about the disease.
Absolutely. So what we've learned here is really that ruxolitinib has good durability of response. And for the patients that withdrew and then were put back on ruxolitinib, they often had repigmentation. So it's not a one-stop shop, meaning you can only use ruxolitinib once. You can. Let's say that life gets crazy, you lose your cream in an airport or whatever, and you have loss of your pigment, you can restart it, and there is the ability for ruxolitinib to work again. So I think that is a very important point for patients to understand as well.
Yeah, and I think this kind of transitions to what is going to be the impact this has in our patients. Hopefully, there's going to be encouragement of the individuals that come in saying they felt like they've never had therapeutic options for a long time, or we can actually point out saying, okay, here is some short-term data, some medium-term data, some long-term data, all taking a look at efficacy and safety for this one option. And we know that, you know, ruxolitinib cream isn't going to be the choice for everybody. There's going to be issues on individuals with extremely high body surface areas that may not meet other aspects of the criteria. And so I don't think we're here to say that this is a panacea, but this is such a big, important step for really a large chunk of patients who have significant involvement, you know, not only the face, but other areas. And so I think that this is probably going to hopefully drive even more individuals to see their dermatology healthcare providers to actually talk about treatment for a disease that, if anything, they feel like they've been turned away for a long time.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned that we've been talking a lot about the facial response versus total body, and you mentioned earlier about hands, feet, or really areas very difficult to repigment, and that's true in the ruxolitinib trials too. It's a much more difficult area to repigment in vitiligo, period. But I think that one of the things that really tailors towards focusing on the face is that the face is what we see every day when we communicate. I do have a lot of patients that are in business, and when they go to shake hands, they're very self-conscious about their hands. But generally, the face is what we think of when we have that self-conscious social anxiety about meeting other people first. And so I do think that these results are really meaningful for that reason, is that this the aesthetics usually for most people starts top down. And so I think that this is really good. Now, what's it coming in the future? So you talked about a lot of the science, and you mentioned chemokines, and you even threw out a few chemokines, CXCL9, 10, 11. So it turns out that the true V studies with ruxolitinib actually are ongoing to look at biomarkers. So you were talking a little bit about the need to really study these different molecular endotypes, but it turns out that one of the biomarkers that's being studied right now is CXCL10, and they're trying to correlate response with CXCL10 levels. So I think that some of the biomarker research around ruxolitinib and JAK inhibition and vitiligo is going to be very exciting and hopefully tells us a little bit more about the mechanism of action in this disease.
If I have to throw out the thing I'm excited about before we kind of wrap it up here, I think that the fact that we're going to have oral therapies potentially very soon, right, that some are using similar mechanisms that we've seen with topical ruxolitinib, some perhaps slightly newer targets, but there's several actually compounds in various stages of development, including close to phase 3 and beyond, where we actually may have options for that patient that has very extensive involvement over the whole body surface area or where the cream may not be entirely practical. So I think the fact that we're understanding more about the science and may have more treatment options is really going to be one of the biggest things, as I see, that excites me so much for the future of vitiligo.
Absolutely.